Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, January 31st, 2009. I'm Harley Schlanger. I will be your host today. During his most recent webcast on January 22nd, Lyndon LaRouche stated several times that this is a moment for qualified optimism. The British-controlled Cheney Bush team is gone, their policies repudiated by the voters, and a new president has been inaugurated with an approval rating of 74%. Yet, at the same time, we're plunging deeper into a global existential crisis. The continuing collapse of the physical economy can be seen in the daily reports of new mass layoffs, over 100,000 last week, while the efforts to bail out the zombie banks to protect their fraudulent valuations of their toxic assets have done nothing to loosen credit, but are instead creating an accelerating volume, a new bubble of bloated, toxic financial waste. There's a push to send more U.S. troops into Afghanistan. The Congress is still under the control of Nancy Pelosi, who LaRouche said this week must resign or be driven from her leadership position as Speaker of the House. And I might add, despite the effective job done by the LaRouche Youth Movement and LaRouche PAC TV to put a spotlight on Nazi George Soros and his operations to expand the effects of the ongoing opium war worldwide, Soros's backers at the Financial Times posted a series of articles promoting him and his total support for the deregulated speculator's paradise, which is causing the collapse of the world economy and threatening the lives of billions of people. So the question is an obvious one. Why should we have qualified optimism as we move into 2009 and the first days of the Obama administration? Joining me today in a special LaRouche show will be EIR senior editor Jeffrey Steinberg. For today's program, he will be my only guest, as we wish to present you with the best uninterrupted global strategic assessment, in which we will cover a number of critical areas to guide you in your organizing and your activity. This is not a passive report from Jeffrey, but a battle orientation. So, Jeffrey, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot, Harley.
In his webcast, Lynn stated several times that he's approaching the present strategic situation with qualified optimism. To me, I took that to mean that there's real potential for improvement. As you might say, we're out of the bushes, but not yet out of the woods. Now, after the first 10 days in office and the direction globally, what do you see at present?
Well, I think that I would strongly put emphasis on the word qualified for two reasons. Number one, one of the things that I know impressed Mr. LaRouche was the cabinet selection and the selection of other key people who will be staffing, particularly the top national security posts, and a very clear indication that that selection process was aimed at avoiding some of the mistakes that actually were made during the early years of the Clinton presidency. For example, the appointment of General Jones as the national security advisor made it clear that Obama will be seeking a very smooth and collaborative relationship with the nation's armed forces. And that's particularly appropriate given that the uniformed military were actually a critical element of the anti-war movement during the 8 years of Bush and Cheney, particularly the efforts that were made in the second term to prevent an attack on Iran. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the appointment of General Shinseki as head of Veterans Affairs, somebody who had gone to war with Rumsfeld and Cheney over Iraq and over the size of the military deployment. His choice as VA was a very, very strong, unambiguous signal. Obviously,
I think you'd have to put the Hillary Clinton appointment.
Exactly. That's what I was getting to next. Yeah. Hillary Clinton not only represented 18 million plus Democratic voters, but brings a lot of experience. And it's a kind of a twofer because you've got the whole experience of her husband, former President Bill Clinton, that will be a cooperative factor in the equation. So qualified in the sense that there are qualified people coming in to be the key advisors to the president. George Mitchell's selection as the special envoy to the Middle East, especially coming after the horrors of the Israeli atrocities against Gaza, was also welcome.
Let me just ask you on that. Are these appointments seen by allies of the United States as a sign of a significant change?
Well, I had a series of meetings, and my wife also yesterday in Washington. We were at a number of Arab embassies and some South Asian countries as well. And the Mitchell appointment, the fact that President Obama reached out to the Muslim world in his inaugural address, and the fact that he delivered his very first international news interview as a president to Al Arabiya in the Persian Gulf all sent good signals. But really, the test is now before him, and he's going to have to demonstrate a level of both real strategic understanding, and he's going to have to also show an enormous amount of guts and leadership skills in the face of what will be massive efforts at sabotage. His problem right off the bat is going to be confronting certain ideological problems that have been handed down to his generation from the baby boomers, especially a propensity to give grounds to a lot of flagrantly anti-scientific ideas about environmentalism. And we see this as a substantial flaw within the stimulus package. There's understanding on the part of Mr. LaRouche of the desire to do something to roll back the job losses that we've seen in the economy over a long haul, but especially over the last year. And so the idea in principle of concentrating on creating millions of new jobs is appropriate. But there is an enormous difference between a windmill and a nuclear power plant. There's an enormous difference between filling a pothole or simply upgrading a bridge that's due for repairs versus launching a nationwide high-speed and maglev mass transportation grid.
Well, that brings me to the obvious question, which I'll get to in just a second. I want to tell our listeners that we are set up to take your emails today. If you have some questions for Jeff, you can send them to him at radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio@larouchepub, LaRouchePub.com. And I'd also like to encourage people to go back to the LaRouche Pack website when we're done today. And if you haven't heard it yet, listen to Lyndon LaRouche's January 22nd webcast, where he discusses these questions in great detail and takes questions from a broad grouping of people who are involved in the institutions that are making the decisions now. So, Jeff, what you were just describing in terms of the problem with environmentalism and so on, I guess the first thing we should look at is this question of the financial crisis, the fact that this last week we saw layoffs across the board. We see the banks are continuing to collapse. At Davos, Switzerland, there were a whole series of proposals presented, most of which were the same, more bailout, more money. And then you have the stimulus plan. Where do we stand on this thing? I mean, where does it look like it's headed?
Well, let's start with the reality of the situation. The entire Federal Reserve system, from the Fed down to all of the major American commercial banks, is hopelessly and irreversibly bankrupt. The amount of toxic non-performing debt on the books of the entire financial system can never be paid. What we're looking at minimum, is $1.4 quadrillion in currently outstanding derivatives contracts. So the whole system is going to have to be put through bankruptcy reorganization. And there's no way to evade or postpone or soft pedal on that issue. Now, this is something that we know that some people in the Obama economics team are grappling with. But so far, they've not come out with anything that really represents a clear recognition that it's the whole system that's bankrupt and must be put through bankruptcy reorganization. And it's been announced earlier today that sometime in the very near future, probably during this coming week, the newly confirmed Treasury Secretary Geithner and others will be presenting a comprehensive approach to dealing with the banking crisis, the home foreclosures crisis. But anything short of an announcement of a full-scale bankruptcy reorganization is not going to do the job. So even on that very, very fundamental issue, Mr. LaRouche's concern is that there may be either a lack of understanding of the problem or a tendency to equivocate and try for piecemeal solutions when no such option is available.
Well, Mr. LaRouche did say that one thing you can expect would be some stumbles coming out of the gate. But on the other hand, he made the point that with a 74% approval rating, you're not going to ever really improve on that. This is the time to move. I guess we'll see what Geithner proposes this week. But what's your assessment of the stimulus plan? Because it does appear as though it's coming under attack now obviously from the Republican side. But I think there are some problems embedded within it.
Well, let's look at it from the standpoint of the conceptual flaw that permeates it. And I'm saying this because Mr. LaRouche's view is very different than it was during the 8 years of Bush and Cheney, where right. We knew we had an enemy occupation of the White House. And there was very little purpose and very little prospect of Bush or Cheney responding in any positive way to anything that LaRouche was saying. But in the case of the Obama administration, it's quite different. So the criticisms that we're discussing should be seen as remedies to possible mistakes with the idea that we've got a team in office that has an intent to do the right thing. And therefore, the harsh words which may be heard at some time from Mr. LaRouche are being done with the idea not that these are insurmountable problems, but that these are soluble problems if a different conceptual approach is taken. And the idea is that there's people who are capable of grasping ideas even if they didn't come up with them themselves. So here's the conceptual flaw. If you're going to go for a real economic stimulus of the economy, an economy that has been all but completely destroyed, then you have to take a top-down approach and you have to take a high-technology approach. So what are we looking at? We're looking at science. We're looking at the machine tool principle because it's the high-end, high-skilled aspect of the economy that affords the greatest leap in productivity and the greatest prospect for wealth creation and from recovery from the economic catastrophe that we've been living through really since the 1967-68 period. So LaRouche's emphasis is on those things that will have the maximum effect of boosting the productivity of the economy and encouraging employment in the most advanced technological and scientific areas. So if you take something, for example, like high-speed rail, nobody in this country in their right mind would in the least dispute the fact that we need to completely overhaul and build from the ground floor up a nationwide high-speed rail grid, which would involve electrified high-speed rail, and in certain areas, we go immediately to magnetic levitation. And our concept, as Lynn has discussed it, is that this program, perhaps 46,000 miles of new high-speed rail built over the next 20, 30 years, would itself be part of an international high-speed railway system. If we get the project to build the tunnels under the Bering Straits for high-speed rail, then we immediately link up all of Eurasia and Africa with the nations of North, Central, and South America. And so we've got a project in the U.S. We've got a link up through Canada and Alaska to the Bering Straits tunnel link, and then we've got the question of a high-speed rail grid going down all the way to the very southern tip of South America. There's the issue of the Darien Gap Challenge, of a kind of a swampy area on the Panama-Colombia border that's been a challenge for an integrated high-speed mass transit system covering the whole Western Hemisphere for a long time. There was an article in the most recent issue of the EIR, an interview with a leading rail scientist, Hal Cooper, discussing that Darien Gap project. But so a high-speed rail program, what does this entail? For one thing, we're going to need a massive increase in energy where the only remotely feasible form is nuclear power. A massive expansion of construction of nuclear power, fourth, fifth generation nuclear power plants to provide the added required electricity for this high-speed rail grid. You do that kind of project, and immediately a number of critical issues come into play. Number one, you have an enormous requirement for advanced machine tool capacity. So you're creating a demand at the highest end of the productive cycle, machine tool engineers, machine tool designers, to pave the way for a massive construction project that will create millions and millions of jobs. We're going to need the added power. We're going to have to figure out how to begin production of the kind of specialty steel that's required for the containment vessels for large-scale nuclear power plants. So right off the bat, you see that we're talking about something fundamentally different than simply ready-to-go projects that will basically start patching up existing infrastructure. We need some of those things done. We have small dam projects all over the country that are vitally needed, but again, that should be part of an integrated plan for modernization and improvement of our entire nationwide water management system.
Well, that's why you're saying it has to be top down. I have another question on this in a moment, but I want to again give out our email address. If people do want to ask questions, you can send them to us at radio@larouchepub.com. Now, Jeff, in laying this thing out, I mean, one of the obvious questions is the role of the Congress. And this week, as I mentioned at the top of the program, Lyndon LaRouche said that if you want to get something done, Nancy Pelosi has to go. What is it that Pelosi's doing right now?
Look, she's a major impediment to any of the kinds of projects that we're talking about. And you've got already an existing bill of indictment against her. When she first came in as the Speaker of the House after the 2006 midterm elections, there was a clear, really unambiguous mandate from the voters who swept the Republicans out of the majority in both the House and the Senate. And it centered around three issues: impeach Vice President Cheney, bring the troops back from Iraq, and begin action to deal with what was already obvious to most Americans as a severe economic crisis, even before the July 2007 blowout of the financial bubble.
And she sabotaged action on all three of those points.
Right, and some of it went back even to the period before she became Speaker, between the 2004 elections and the midterm elections, when she was the minority leader in the House and sabotaged LaRouche's Economic Recovery Act, which would have been the last gasp chance of actually saving the auto industry by retooling it for exactly the kinds of high technology infrastructure projects that we're talking about. She sabotaged that. She announced publicly that impeachment of Cheney was off the table. And in particular, after LaRouche's July 2007 webcast announcing that the crash was on and also announcing a very concrete solution to that crisis, what later was drafted as legislation called the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act, Pelosi did everything in her power to make sure that the HBPA, despite massive support at the grassroots level in state legislatures and city councils in every part of the country, never came before the Congress. So the bailout bill of September, October 2008 was the lawful continuation of a string of actions that she took to sabotage any possibility of positive action to deal with the bankruptcy of the banks and the threat that millions of American families faced of being kicked out of their houses in foreclosure.
So without her misleadership, what we've seen, especially since September, but even going back to last spring and summer with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, none of that would have, or that could have been stopped, had except for her.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, look, you go back to the period when the big three auto companies could have been saved with the kind of capital investment restructuring that LaRouche proposed in his Economic Recovery Act. Not only did Pelosi sabotage it, but there was a very, very clear conflict of interest because one of her closest advisors on all economic policy matters is Felix Rohatyn. And at that time, Rohatyn was directly involved in deals involving the takeover of Visteon, the parts division of General Motors, by some hedge fund cronies. And so Rohatyn's actions led to the loss of tens of thousands of manufacturing jobs in the auto sector, led to the literal shuttering down and dismantling of productive capacity. And so Pelosi should have publicly recused herself from any involvement whatsoever in that auto crisis back in 2005, 2006, when something could have been done about it because of her intimate relationship with Felix Rohatyn. These are the kinds of issues that we're going to have to take very seriously if we're going to get to the bottom of why it is that we are now living through a financial and monetary and economic collapse orders of magnitude more severe than the Great Depression of the 30s. As LaRouche said, we need a PCORA commission, a no-holds-barred congressional investigation with full subpoena power into the causes of the current financial collapse. But you're not going to get that if Pelosi's Speaker of the House. So well, her removal is critical for the success of President Obama.
I think the listeners should keep their eye on the LaRouche PAC website, because we will be posting something in the next days, some kind of resolution which would incorporate removal of Pelosi and the establishment of a PCORA commission. I know the California, the LaRouche Youth Movement in California, drafted a resolution which was presented last night to the Resolutions Committee of the L.A. County Democratic Central Committee, which is one of the largest, if not the largest, county Democratic Party in the country. I don't have a report on that, but we'll be posting that. And you can keep it updated on this by going to the LaRouchePAC.com website. You're listening to The LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, January 31st, 2009, and I'm speaking with Jeffrey Steinberg. And I'd like to move now to a couple of broader strategic issues, Jeff. The first one is Afghanistan. There's obviously a fight developing over this. It's directly related to a topic that you are familiar with from your research for many, many years. For those who don't know it, Jeff was one of the authors of the groundbreaking book Dope Incorporated, which came out, I believe, in 1978.
79, the first
79.
Edition, yeah.
All right, so what is going on now with Afghanistan? I know Lyndon LaRouche is emphatic that the United States must not send more troops in, but must treat it as a war on drugs. What can you tell us about that situation?
Well, the general public announcements from the Pentagon would indicate that the U.S. is planning on sending 30,000 approximately additional troops into Afghanistan between now and the end of this year. And LaRouche's point is very simply that anyone who's even begun to study the history of Afghanistan or who looks at the current on-the-ground situation there will realize right off the bat, A, that you cannot win a quote-unquote war in Afghanistan militarily. You will not suppress the Afghan people through military counterinsurgency and through occupation methods. It just ain't going to happen. If Alexander the Great couldn't do it, if the Soviet Red Army couldn't do it, if the British couldn't do it, then there's no reason to presume that the circumstances are so different today that the United States and NATO are going to be able to do it.
But don't some of these Pentagon people study the most recent case? Because some of them were very close to what was happening with the Soviet situation. Maybe they don't know Alexander the Great and the great game between Britain and Russia in the 19th century, but surely this 1980 to 1989 war would be fairly prominent.
Well, yeah, of course. And, you know, there's all kinds of studies that have been done. In some cases, you've got people who are just sort of caught in a pragmatic trap. And among the U.S. military, aside from the fact that for some people there is a kind of a tendency towards a kind of a Nietzschean world outlook, the problem is that you have among senior flag grade officers, many of whom were junior officers in Vietnam, there is an aversion from any situation where it might appear that the United States was either militarily defeated or the United States was forced to cut and run. And so there is a tendency to miss the bigger picture and try to find some way to hunker down and do a better job of the counterinsurgency method, and it's doomed to fail. The other aspect of it is that I think in fairness, it should be said that there is a top-to-bottom policy review going on right now. General Petraeus is one of the people involved in that. And when the military comes up with some kind of a recommendation and plan, they're going to take it to the president, the vice president, and Secretaries Gates and Clinton and the NSC advisor, General Jones. And so that hasn't happened yet. So in fairness, we can't say what the outcome will be.
And, Jeff, what do you make of the Der Spiegel article, which says that one of the U.S. commanders in Afghanistan, in fact, is saying what Lyndon LaRouche is saying, which is that we have to have a crackdown on drugs?
Well, that's exactly right. Look, in fact, a report was leaked to Der Spiegel this past week in an attempt to sabotage a new policy initiative coming directly out of the commander, the U.S. Army General, John Craddock, who is the NATO commander. So it's coming from the very highest levels of the American and the NATO military structures, a recognition that the insurgency in Afghanistan is a narco-insurgency. It's funded almost exclusively from the opium proceeds, and any kind of effective operation in Afghanistan to stabilize the place has to begin with a war on drugs. Now, just to give a little bit more technical detail, because I think people will want to understand this. At the very outset of the NATO phase of the Afghanistan operation, when NATO formally took charge of the military operations, stabilization operations in Afghanistan after the 2001 U.S. invasion, the North Atlantic Council, which is the policymaking body of NATO, defined the rules of engagement for NATO forces. And they did not provide authority for the drug traffickers, the opium lords, to be gone after. Now, 8 years into the conflict in Afghanistan, it's become crystal clear to everybody who wants to honestly look at the situation, that the opium issue is fundamental. And so what General Craddock did in early January is to send instructions to the people in NATO directly in charge of the Afghanistan mission that you don't have to prove in advance a link between the drug traffickers and the insurgents to go after the drug traffickers. In other words, he was making a kind of statement of reality that the whole insurgency is a narco-insurgency, and therefore you can't separate out the drug production from the insurgents.
And Jeff, isn't this, I know you were in India not that long ago with Mr. LaRouche, and we saw the atrocities in Mumbai. Isn't it the case that in looking at this thing that the narco traffic is a key aspect of terrorism throughout that region?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, you could say the same thing globally.
Yeah.
There's really not a major terrorist or asymmetric warfare organization on the planet that's not in one way or the other involved in drug trafficking. Look, the Drug Enforcement Administration in the last 6 months announced that they had placed the Kurdish Workers Party, the PKK, on the list of major narcotics trafficking organizations because they are instrumental in one of the three major smuggling routes coming out of Afghanistan for the heroin and opium making its way into Europe. Now, on this Afghanistan situation, you've got a real freak out coming from the British. Mm-hmm. And in the case of this specific leak to Der Spiegel, there's every reason to believe that it either came directly from certain British networks within NATO or possibly some of the German greenie networks, which could be why it is that it surfaced in Der Spiegel. So this is an attempt to sabotage a major corrective in the policy towards Afghanistan. We don't need a Vietnam-style endless counterinsurgency campaign in Afghanistan. In fact, what Mr. LaRouche said is only retain enough troops to serve to provide security for the capital city of Kabul and then concentrate on a major attack on the drugs. Now, most of the way you conduct a war on drugs is non-lethal. You have satellite capability of identifying the location of every speck of the earth where opium or coca or marijuana are being grown. There are safe herbicides that have been developed to eradicate those crops and those crops alone. And none of that, other than defensive measures against possible attack, should involve any kind of lethal force. You've got an international banking system that is in a state of complete collapse, and the only available liquid capital around this planet today is the proceeds from drug money and related organized crime activity. The head of the United Nations Anti-Narcotics and Crime Bureau, Mr. Costa, has given a series of interviews in recent weeks saying that the only free money out there is dope money. So you tackle the Afghanistan problem, where 95% of all of the heroin and 92% of all of the opium worldwide is produced. Latest estimates are 8,200 metric tons of opium grown in Afghanistan per year.
Jeff, let me just to wrap up the Afghanistan question for the moment. I believe I read in the our update yesterday that there are some indications that there are leading people in Russia who have rejected sending military aid to Afghanistan, but say they're open to collaboration on the drug question, given that they know that these are the same networks that are funding the operations in Chechnya and elsewhere. What can you tell us about that?
Well, there's two things to say. One is that, yes, Russia is very interested. Viktor Ivanov, who's the head of the Russian anti-narcotics police, has given a series of interviews, including the one you just mentioned, saying that collaboration in eradicating the opium production in Afghanistan is something that the Russians would be very, very interested in discussing with the new Obama administration in the United States. Second thing that goes to the same general approach and is in some respects even more interesting is that Admiral Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, a few days ago identified Iran as a natural ally of the United States in dealing with the Afghan problem. Now, there is probably no single country outside of Afghanistan itself and perhaps Pakistan that's suffering more from this torrential flow of opium out of Afghanistan. The largest amount of literally combat activity between the drug smugglers and law enforcement agencies and military agencies is taking place in Iran. The highest number of police and military casualties in combat against drug smugglers is in Iran. Iran is facing I wouldn't even call it an epidemic, I'd call it a pandemic of drug addiction. I just got a report from somebody who had gotten to speak to someone who just was in Tehran in the last few weeks. He said, in the middle of Tehran, there is a needle park where you see young people right out there in broad daylight shooting up drugs, probably mostly heroin. And the estimate is that the drug addiction rate among Iranians is somewhere between 25 and 28% of the total population. And, of course, you've got a border between Afghanistan and Iran running through the Balochistan area, which is one of the major smuggling routes out of Afghanistan for heroin and opium bound primarily for Europe.
Okay, I just want to let our listeners know we're getting some emails coming in. You can send us your questions at radio@larouchepub.com. I have a couple more questions for Jeff, and then I will turn to the email. So if you have a question that you think is critical, please send it in right now. Jeff, I want to pick up on two other situations just briefly, but I think they're important for fitting this whole picture in. Lynn has written repeatedly, Lyndon LaRouche, on the problems in Russia recently, and we saw another indication of that at with the speech given by Vladimir Putin at Davos, that on the one hand you have this Ivanov offer to work on drugs, on the other hand you have fairly strange and comments coming from Russian leaders that seem to indicate that they still see this as an American problem and not a global economic crisis. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, there's obviously something that's going on in the leadership circles in Russia that's pretty unsavory. Mr. LaRouche has said that he does not have a really detailed window into exactly what's going on or why. There's clearly certain European networks that are trying to convince the Russians to align against the United States at a moment that Lyndon LaRouche is saying that the survival of the planet, the only basis for a new global financial system, is for the United States, Russia, China, and India to be lead collaborators because too much of Europe is dominated by the Anglo-Dutch liberal system of globalization and free trade, which is the disease that's driving us towards a new dark age. So it's a problem, but, you know, I think that there will be there's been discussions between President Medvedev and President Obama. There will be a G20 meeting in London in early April. I expect there'll be a trip overseas by Secretary of State Clinton very soon, and I would think and would hope that Russia would be a major stop along that route. So I think that there's a big problem, a severe problem. It derives from the fact that the Russians, number one, had thought that they were relatively immune from the global financial collapse. It was foolish to think that, but they were clinging to that delusion for quite some time. Secondly, the Russians made a fundamental mistake in failing to take advantage of the opportunity presented by those hyperinflationary oil prices for the better part of last year to launch a major investment program in infrastructure and in modernization of their heavy industry. They didn't do that. Instead, that money was frittered away sitting in the so-called stability fund, and probably a lot of that money was lost in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and European banking bonds and the rest. So Russia is facing a terrible dilemma. And again, if we get the right kind of leadership initiative, if we get President Obama keying off of LaRouche's call for a four powers collaboration to create a new Bretton Woods system, a bankruptcy reorganization, a return to fixed exchange rates, a constituting of a credit system by treaty agreement for great infrastructure projects all over the world. If the U.S. goes with that, I think we can solve the Russian problem. But that is really what brings us back to the issue that we started out with.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Namely, that the Obama administration, even as it's just sort of settling in and getting its feet on the ground, has got to have an orientation towards tackling these grave civilizational crises from the top down. And without a kind of unified top-down approach to the collapse of the world's physical economy, to the bankruptcy of the global financial system, to the need to eradicate this plague and scourge of drugs that's getting completely out of control, then LaRouche's concern is that certain mistakes made early on can be very, very hard to reverse down the line.
Well, and I know you and I have each had an opportunity in the last week to get a sense of how people are thinking about this. I was up in Boston last Saturday for a very successful town meeting. You were in Detroit, I believe, Wednesday night, another very successful town meeting. And it's clear that people do want solutions. There's a heightened sense of hope. I just want to let people know among our listeners that I will be out on the West Coast for a couple of town meetings coming up this coming week, Thursday night in San Francisco and Saturday afternoon in Granada Hills. The details of those are posted on the LaRouchePAC.com website, and there'll be more of these kinds of meetings to come, so you can check them out. Stay in touch with the LaRouche PAC website. Jeff, we have about 15 minutes. There's one note that just is a sort of a follow-up, an email from Santiago Hilaret, who asks a question about the basically the problem of gloating. From he said some of the governments in Ibero-America seeing this as a U.S. problem. Putin himself used the words that he doesn't want to gloat about the U.S. economic crisis. But and then the question he asks is whether you have a sense that there's progress being made with the work being done by the youth movement, particularly with the LaRouche PAC TV spots. Are we reaching people to present this idea of a unity of republics against the this neoliberal paradigm? I think that this is what we saw with the meetings, but do you have some thoughts on that?
Well, I think that there's always more work to be done, but the qualitative improvements in particularly the video products on the LaRouche Political Action Committee website are pretty stunning. I would really, in the specific context of the kinds of international projects that nations have to get together and collaborate around, I'd flag particular attention to the video, I think 45 or 50-minute video on the LPAC site on the Plino project, yeah, which is a water project involving the United States and Mexico, and it's just exemplary of the kind of great projects that are on the drawing board, ready to go. In some cases, they've been on the drawing board since the late 1960s and earlier, and are just simply waiting for capital budgeting and for decisions by governments to move ahead with these programs. So the website is clearly being watched and studied. We get feedback all the time here in Washington from people who are just bowled over by the quality of what's being produced. And I can only promise it's going to get bigger and better.
Yeah, I think our listeners, some of them are aware of this. If you're not, go to LaRouchePAC.com. Get your friends to go to it. I mean, we need a situation where we literally have a million people a week getting online. Now, it takes a while to build that. We don't have George Soros' money to do advertisements and put pop-ups on every single website on the Internet. But we do have boots on the ground. We have people who can organize, and it's critical we get that support. And it's also critical that LaRouche PAC be included in your funding operations for this year. I know times are tough. When times are tough, that's when you need someone who will fight for your interests, and that's what we do. Now, I want to bring up the Middle East because this is the other key area. You have, as you said, the special envoy, former Senator George Mitchell, will be going there. You have the flap at Davos between the Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan and the Israeli President Peres over Gaza. There are elections coming up in Israel. But it seems to me that what Lyndon LaRouche's approach has been from the beginning is that the problem is only addressed when you go after the British orientation, the British control of the situation through the old Sykes-Picot agreements, and that the way to break that, the best way to break it, would be with an Israel-Syria treaty agreement. Is that still Lynn's view of the situation?
In general, absolutely, yes. I should say right off the bat that the LaRouche Pub, the Executive Intelligence Review magazine, website, which is www.larouchepub.com, has posted as of several days ago an extraordinary historical report on the U.S. fight against Sykes-Picot, and it includes a very detailed profile of the history of the Jabotinskyite movement, the outright fascist movement in Israel. LaRouche commissioned that because he wanted to put a strategic spotlight on these upcoming Israeli elections just 11 days from now. And if Benjamin Netanyahu is elected prime minister, it will make the task for President Obama, Secretary of State Clinton, Special Envoy Mitchell, and anybody else who wants to solve this problem a hell of a lot more difficult, because Netanyahu is literally a second-generation Jabotinskyite fascist.
And his father was the U.S. Secretary for Jabotinsky.
And then when Jabotinsky died in 1940, Netanyahu's father actually became the leader, the successor, as head of the Zionist revisionist movement. And so this is an immediate issue. If Netanyahu is elected, then it could prove to be the final act of political suicide by the Israeli people, proving that they've just demonstrated a lack of moral fitness to survive. Now, yes, of course, the Israel-Syria track is the thing that's most immediately available. But LaRouche received a report in the last 48 hours, a kind of an on-the-ground, after-action report on what actually occurred in Gaza. And I think there's a few things that need to be said about that.
Mm-hmm.
During the first 4 days of the attack, and this is completely ignoring the fact that the attack was completely unwarranted, unjustified, and unnecessary. But the fact is that if you wanted to consider it a, quote, legitimate Israeli military operation, after the first 4 days, the Israelis had hit everything that you could conceivably, by any stretch of the imagination, call a legitimate military target if you're viewing Hamas as a military enemy. And the Israelis claim that there's like 1,200 legitimate military targets. There's really about 120 if you wanted to even stretch it. But on day four, the Israeli operation fundamentally changed in character. There were no more military targets to hit, to speak of. And so what was launched was a campaign of extermination against the population of the Gaza Strip. The Israelis launched a war of annihilation against a civilian population. And that is a crime against humanity that must be punished. And LaRouche's view is that first and foremost, Benjamin Netanyahu must be prevented from being elected as the next Israeli prime minister. Of course, people will say, yes, but it was Olmert, it was Livni, it was Barak who did this. But the fact is that they caved in to pressure from precisely the extreme right wing, the fanatical fundamentalist settlers movement, the Avigdor Lieberman extreme right wing blood and soil fascists. And Netanyahu was the spokesman and the point person for that point of view in Israel. If Netanyahu gets in, then you may very well kiss the whole Middle East goodbye.
And
after
that is
the atrocity.
His whole apparatus includes the hardcore groupings that have even been identified by people from the Israeli media as having fascist viewpoints, the greater Israel crowd around Lieberman and others.
Exactly.
Well, this is I have had a chance to read the EIR report, and it's absolutely breathtaking to see this picture, that it can be put together so that you can understand it. 100 years of British manipulations in the region. And this is something that is gets back to the final point I'd like to bring up. You know, this question of the Anglo-Dutch-Saudi operation. We do have a question from Alexandru Papoiu, I think, a doctor, who asks about 9/11. Is Obama afraid to break the silence about September 11th? I mean, that really does get at this question of the Saudi role. What's the most effective way to mobilize to defeat this Anglo-Dutch-Saudi mob? I know you identified the drug question. That may be one of their vulnerabilities. They're hurting from the financial collapse. How do we get at this network? What do we do?
Well, I think that there's two critical vulnerable flanks to be gone after with a very, very high profile, full official investigation. Number one, the Al-Yamama Project, which is at the heart of this Anglo-Saudi deal.
That's the BAE British Aerospace.
That's exactly right. It's the barter deal that was initiated by Prince Bandar, by Margaret Thatcher in 1985, continues to this day, and has generated the largest illegal offshore slush fund for black intelligence operations that's ever been created in the history of mankind. It makes the British East India Company look like a little bathtub navy in comparison.
They have one of their key operatives still in the region, namely Tony Blair.
Yeah, exactly. Blair is running around basically continuing the work of Dick Cheney, arguing that the real fault lines in the Middle East are between moderates and extremists, and he's basically preaching a doctrine of war against Hamas, Hezbollah, and Iran at a point that the Obama administration is looking to reverse and pull back from the insanity of that British policy that was imposed through the Bush-Cheney White House. Now, the second thing that ought to be done is dust off the files, the suppressed investigation into the 9/11 attacks, and just start looking at the evidence of the involvement of Saudi intelligence networks in that operation. And then begin asking yourself, where did Osama bin Laden come out of in the first place? Wasn't he an asset of the Anglo-Saudi aspect of the Afghanistan war to drive the Soviets out of Afghanistan from 79 to 1990? And are we indeed looking at a capability that was unleashed precisely to give Cheney, Rumsfeld, Bush the pretext for dictatorship? They didn't quite get it. They tried, but they didn't fully succeed. But the 9/11 attack defined the drive for a totalitarian dictatorship over the United States that defined everything about the Bush administration from that moment on.
And Jeff, this track that you're talking about would also get right to the drug money laundering through Dubai and through other areas that are under British control.
Absolutely. Britain is doping. Doping is the replacement for the East India Company. Do a study of what they did in China and India in the 19th century and look at Afghanistan today, and the light bulbs will go off.
And you'll also get to George Soros and the connection between this Anglo-Dutch-Saudi mob and the collapse of the global financial system.
Right.
Jeff, we really could use another hour for this, but this has been very helpful, I'm sure, for our listeners. You've been listening to Jeff Steinberg on The LaRouche Show. You can pick this up in archive form on LaRouchePub.com. Just look on the left-hand side for LaRouche Show. Also, Jeff's writings appear every single week on LaRouchePub.com and in the Executive Intelligence Review and Electronic Intelligence Weekly, which you can get through those websites. We're out of time, Jeff. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Harley. We'll do it again soon.
And join us next week, Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern, for the next edition of The LaRouche Show.